Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about farmers markets and community gardens and all sorts of good things like that. Right now, I'd like to welcome Ramos Suina and Jamie Gaskin-Irick. They are with the Institute of American Indian Arts Center for Lifelong Education, which is sponsoring a two-day free conference on youth suicide prevention, August 11th and 12th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
So, we have a real problem with youth suicide in New Mexico. How big a problem is it with Native people in particular?
It's a huge problem. There have been several studies done. One of the latest coming out of the U.S. government health services, and Indian children rank 2.6 higher between the ages of 5 through 14.
Five?
Ages 5 through 14, youth suicide is 2.6% higher than the national average. And Native children 15 through 24 rank 3.3% higher than the national averages. So it's a huge problem.
So some of there's a conference coming up in a week, and some of the sessions kind of suggest the possible causes of youth suicide, which we can talk about it at length. One of them is bullying and gangs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's something that we're just coming around to the reservations or the communities. In the last maybe 10 years, we've noticed that there's some gang activities going on within the reservations, and that's something that we need to address. And I think it's becoming a problem for the tribal leaders. I was talking to a couple of tribal leaders not too long ago, and they wanted to address that issue, but it's become kind of violent many times, and so they're trying to figure out a way how do you address this issue. And how do you address it with the teenagers? Because teenagers seem to have some problems with, including drugs, taking substance abuse and things like this. And so they're very cautious how to handle that. So I think they're trying to bring some expertise. And I think this is one of the reasons why we're addressing this issue. Hopefully that will help.
One of the problems about gangs is that they come in from other cities and, you know, infiltrate places like you know, even smaller towns and so on. Does that happen in Indian country as well?
I think there's a connection with groups coming from those places. Otherwise, that thing wouldn't have been happening. I remember during my growing up days, we dealt with mainly with alcohol and with marijuana.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up at Cochiti Pueblo. I'm from Cochiti. And that was usually the. Then I went to one of the boarding schools here in Santa Fe, and that was the IIA when it first started back in '63. And I know that most of the Indian students coming from not only just from New Mexico, but from other states. That was the main was alcohol abuse, and a little bit of marijuana. But up to these days, it's changed a lot. Now there's drugs coming in,
much heavier drugs,
exactly.
Than those.
And there's an influence coming in from the outside.
And so that has a cause of suicide just because it affects people's brains?
I think attitudes and depression and poverty and drug abuse and everything factors in as a cycle. Depression will hit more profoundly after or during a drinking binge because alcohol is a depressant. Therefore, if a child or a younger or an older student was thinking about a suicidal act, they may be more prone to carry it out with little or no notice, perhaps even if they were planning ahead, if they were drinking or using drugs.
So what are some other reasons for the high rate of suicide that are being studied and that are being addressed in this conference?
I think one of the other main reasons is the dysfunctional families. Either the both parents or maybe one of the parents have abuse, alcohol abuse, and maybe even drugs, and they learn that at early age. And so they think that the younger generation think it's okay to do that if they see their parents doing it. And so I'm pretty sure that's probably some of the causes for suicide.
There's also, excuse me, there's also some peer pressure. A lot of kids will feel like if it's culturally prohibited or not okay in the religious religious practices and the they might be ready to follow suit with their friends. There's peer pressure.
In terms of peer pressure, not towards suicide, but toward drugs and alcohol and those kinds of things?
Drugs and alcohol and also suicide.
There's peer pressure for suicide?
Yes, there can be, with messages that they are perceiving that they got from the person who has, whether it's a boyfriend or girlfriend or brother or sister, they receive messages and they say, it's okay to do this because you should come and join me.
And so, in other words, if one person in a family commits suicide, then another young person would be more likely to do so?
It's very possible, depending on the intervention that they will get and the kind of guidance and support from schools and family and the community at large. That's why this is so important, to bring in communities and schools and administrators and tribal leaders and the entire community. It's like, I know this is an overused phrase, but it does take a village.
Yeah.
Yes, youth suicide has been around for some time, but it hasn't been noticeable, especially in the communities, tribal communities. That's something that the families or the immediate family don't talk about. They see that happening, but then they say, well, it's happened to one person. But if you count the numbers, you can see that it's on the rise. And so I think several of the tribal communities are now taking the issue and are trying to address it now. Just the other day, I was talking to some of the governors locally here, and they were telling me that they had done a suicide prevention, meeting or maybe a conference down at the 8 Northern Pueblos. And so we're kind of coming in the back and trying to do the same thing by bringing a lot of experts to talk about this, because we're talking at the national level, not just only locally. And so hopefully with the information that we gather, and I know that some of the tribal leaders and their young kids from the Pueblos are going to be attending this. So I think it's great that we address this at this time.
Now, there's, as you said, there's people coming in from all over the place, from as far away as Hawaii and other places as well. One of the things that I wondered and how you address this, I would think that before colonialism, the rate of suicide was non-existent. And to what extent does cultural loss or the conflict between different cultures play a role in all of this?
I've talked to several people who said that even though the suicide rate should be lower with cultural practitioners, those who are in Kiva societies, who are practicing traditional religions, that's not always the case.
Really? That's what I was wondering, whether is this a problem that's less on the reservation or more or just as or the same as in cities?
I think it's more prevalent in the cities. And we do have a large number of Native Americans in the cities that have moved down because for jobs and different opportunities. And so I think they're apt to engage with gang activities and different groups that use those kind of things as far as drug abuse.
And just like dropping out, you can never say that cultural discontinuity is the root cause. There are so many factors, and sometimes detachment from the community will be a huge factor and sometimes not.
So what are the effects on a community when a person takes their own life, especially when a young person takes their own life? I would think there'd be quite a ripple effect.
Yeah, it does have an impact on especially the immediate family and the relatives and the community itself. And as I mentioned earlier, this is something that's not spoken about. No one really talks about it because it's a personal type of situation that happens with the families. But now that it's kind of on the rise, the community itself, the tribal officials are trying to address this now. And to look for ways, how do you prevent something like this? And how do you talk to the families to realize that, you know, something like that could happen to other families as well, and not just only to that particular family? And so hopefully we can address something here. And we are bringing these experts to talk about that. And so we invite whoever can come and join us.
Our director of CLE is Hayes Lewis, and he's Zuni. He's former superintendent of Zuni Schools, a former school principal there. He's had an awful lot of experience with this issue and worked with Teresa LaFramboise, who's from Stanford University, who's one of our speakers at this event. She's on the faculty of the psychology department there. They did a Zuni life skills development program project out of Stanford. Worked there for a number of years, developing some intervention strategies and working with the community and the leaders and the students and the parents to stress life skills development rather than suicide prevention. Because
right.
some communities believe that discussing death is a taboo.
Right.
Rather than discussing death, their center was, let's work on life and our life path rather than the death of these students, and let's start discussing it before it's too late. Talking about life rather than the death.
Mm-hmm. And so life skills included a whole lot of things. One of the things is peer-to-peer training that you also are working on during the conference.
Right.
By the way, we're talking about the Institute of American Indian Arts Center for Lifelong Education 2-day free conference on youth suicide, which is on August 11th and 12th, which people are welcome to sign up for, and we'll give the number and the website and everything at the end. Life skills and peer-to-peer counseling. Peer-to-peer counseling, are you talking about getting young people like in the school system to be able to talk to each other and recognize dangers?
I think the best educators in those areas would be individuals who probably used to maybe abuse drugs, or people who have been falling into that situation, and they're good teachers, and they can work with young kids, and some of them are young enough to associate and to work with these young individuals.
And peer counseling doesn't necessarily mean that that their peers, their high school buddies, are trained in suicide intervention. It just means they're listening and they're monitoring their friends and their situations. And if something arises, if there's a red flag that comes up, or somebody says, you know what, I'm just thinking about this, then that friend can go alert the right people, so there can be intervention by a trained professional and by the families and the school administrators.
So another thing that is going on in the conference is there is a section, where did I see it? It's about, cultural education and traditional games for prevention and for leadership. Yeah, games.
Yeah,
I like games.
I do. They're fun.
I remember some of the, when I was growing up, we had all kinds of games that we play. One of the games that we play is the Sheeny game. It's similar to like the hockey game. And both the adults, it's a kind of an intergenerational game that we have. And we play that in the Pueblos. And that game can last anywhere from a whole day to even going to the next day. And during that time, there's a lot of betting going on. So it's a good stress relief type of program that we have. And now it's being introduced. Of course, a lot of the tribe or the local communities don't have that, but they're working with the kids to address through the games. And then there's other things that we have played before that, too, as well. But maybe Jamie can talk more about it because she works with Hamas, and this is one of the things that they're doing.
Joseph Toledo is a great motivating speaker and native of Hamas Pueblo. He's also a healer. And he uses bow and arrow and native games and to not only impart some cultural wisdom and some life lessons, but also get kids active and out there playing sports. And he teaches students at Hamas and elsewhere how to actually make a bow and arrow, how to make a shinny stick, go out and gather the wood, why it's culturally significant, the place where you gather the materials, how you paint them, What's the background here for you as a native boy or girl? So it encompasses the whole aspect. It makes the kids aware of maybe what they haven't been taught before in their families or their traditions, and also gets them working together in team building, which is real important.
Now, I wonder sometimes about doing an activity like this, a 2-day conference, in the context of just your typical conference, you know, in a building, you're indoors, there's a time schedule, and, you know, and you're, it's such a different culture than a lot of the cultures that you're trying to really revitalize in terms of the traditions that can help prevent suicide. Is there, like, a weird, tension there? You know, caffeine and sugar snacks.
We try to get fresh fruit in there. We try to
bring some healthy food in there rather than give them a lot of Cokes or any of that sweet stuff that they have.
Right.
But I think it's a good idea. I know that the community meetings that they have, they usually have what they call potlucks where people bring food in, all kinds of stuff. And that usually generates a lot of interest, both intergenerational, both adults and young students. So, and we try to kind of piggyback on those kind of activities as well. Hopefully we can do more of that, or we can bring families in.
We usually have healthy breaks. Mm-hmm. Our colleague Lee Lewis gives exercise breaks, work and play at the same time. Get your mind healthy, jump up and down, do a hula hoop, do a team building exercise. Those are kind of good icebreakers as well. So we try to intersperse those in our conferences.
So it's not your tip, because I mean, in the past when I've gone to conferences, by afternoon I'm ready to die a thousand mm-hmm. deaths from fatigue and yes. non-body movement and so on.
Yes.
Yeah, Lee Lewis is very good at doing that, breaking the ice and having everybody stretch so you don't fall asleep. So she does a great job for us.
What are some of the, I don't know if you can talk about some of the actual red flags that people might see in others, in young people or whoever, who might be in danger of taking their own lives.
Sometimes there are none. From what research that I've read, sometimes there are no red flags at all. In my family, we had a personal experience. One of my nephews committed suicide, unfortunately, and he was a bright, articulate, talented, handsome young man who seemed to have everything going for him, and one night he died. Sometimes there are no red flags. Sometimes there are a whole bunch of them, with behavior, becoming very quiet, becoming introspective, getting bad grades, starting to cut school. I am not a psychologist, but I think it could, depending on personality and circumstance and family, it could run the gamut from no warning signs at all to a lot of them.
In the Indian communities, I think it's really hard to identify any kind of red flags because many of the people, like myself, don't have any experience in that area. So I can't really tell who's at the verge of maybe committing suicide or whatever. So I don't really know the signs. So I think that's one of the problems, difficulties that we have to identify something like that.
In programs, this is not the first time that you've done this, or is it the first of this kind of conference?
This is going to be our second time that we've done this.
So in the past, in the programs that have already been tried, what has proved to be most successful?
Basically, just sharing the information with the tribal communities. And also with the state, the kind of programs that state has, and some of them is the counties, because counties have certain, and just having the connection and collaborations with each one of them to know where to go. If anything should come up, if you actually know how to red tag something like this, then you have an idea where to go to, who to contact. So that really helps a lot. So just kind of sharing the information and who's in charge of it and who's the person to call that could really identify those type of red flags that we're talking about.
Now, who are you hoping will come to this conference?
Anyone who works with youth, school administrators, tribal leaders, parents, even students. I think it's important knowledge for everyone. And I think
it's summer, so students are still free, presumably.
Exactly. I think a gathering like this, and any kind of community gathering with people that you feel you can talk to. this actually forms a small community in a centralized location where somebody who may not have considered it important, or they may not be able to talk about these kind of issues because of personal or cultural taboos, they get a chance to see that it's all right. It's very necessary to discuss this, get it out in the open before it's too late. And for Zuni Pueblo, their suicide rate went down substantially from 98 suicides over 20 years to none in the past 18 years.
Really?
So it's... and I hope
so
I'm getting those figures right.
So this stuff works?
This stuff works.
Yeah.
Communication. And, you know, communication is good in any aspect of life, but particularly when we're dealing with youth problems and knowing that not only the parents and the community members, but the students and children have somewhere to go to feel like this problem isn't, it may be huge to you right now. It may not be so huge in the future. Just let's work through it together.
You know, I have to say, one of the nice things about being an adult is that every problem you have, you realize you can kind of put it in perspective
right.
in a way that you just could not when you were 16 or 18.
Exactly.
Right.
Things can be monumental when you're a kid, and it doesn't mean that because we now know that they weren't, the fact is that if they are for a 16-year-old, then it can be life-threatening,
yeah.
Something we really need to pay attention to.
Talking about the life skills development programs, I'm not sure who actually started which Pueblo first, but I know Zuni was very successful at that, according to Hayes, because he actually ran the program. But Hamas is starting to do that. I was just talking to one of their tribal members that was with us yesterday, and he was saying that they started that program, and they're working all across the board with the parents, elders, and also the young students.
What's one example of a life skill?
I guess just coming together and addressing some of those issues, you know, just making them aware that these things are happening. And I'm not sure exactly what's really involved with it because I'm not familiar with that too much. But apparently it seems to be working pretty well. And I also talked to this Santa Clara governor, and he was telling me that they actually have a task force that they set up to address that kind of issues, not just only suicide, but as far as drug abuse, substance abuse, and all this kind of stuff.
I would think that life skills include anything from, I mean, if you're in school and you've got deadlines and social life, time management, coping mechanisms. A lot of kids don't have, I mean, I remember during high school,
Coping mechanisms?
Coping mechanisms. That was an alien concept. But coping skills and how stress management. You know, some of us adults think that kids don't have a lot of stress. It's magnified when you have not only pressures from school, but also maybe difficulties at home and in relationships.
Ramu Swina and Jamie Gaskin-Irick are with the Institute of American Indian Arts Center for Lifelong Education, and they are part of the group that's sponsoring a 2-day free conference on youth suicide prevention, August 11th and 12th. For more information, people can call 424-2387, and they can also go to the website iaia.edu. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome George Gundry. He is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
So the Farmers Market has a lot to celebrate right now, their new home.
Absolutely.
Tell us about it.
Well, as most folks in Santa Fe, I think, are aware, the Farmers Market is setting up shop permanently for the next 80 years, at least, in the rail yard. And
we'll be very old then.
Yes, yes. And we... have just finished, just wrapping up construction on almost a $5 million building, which will have a 10,000 square foot market pavilion. And we will also still have vending outside during the summer months on the plaza in Alameda in the rail yard. And we plan to move the Saturday market September 6th.
So September 6th, and there's still quite a bit of farmer's market to go, because that's
yes.
like that's harvest time.
Oh, absolutely. So we're currently at three different locations, unfortunately, which kind of underlines the importance of the permanent home. So we have our
Have you lost customers over the summer because of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we have the Saturday market at the PERA parking lot, which is at, you know, at the corner of Paseo and Old Santa Fe Trail, and that's actually been very good because it's a very good location. Or our Tuesday morning market's behind the Children's Museum, and that has really suffered. because of people don't see it and people haven't found
it. They don't know about it.
And they've used to, you know, all these years we've always had the Tuesday and Saturday markets at the same location. Historically, every time the market has moved, and it's now moved 7 times, I believe, business goes down about 25-30% that first year.
And so with this move, that probably won't be the case so much because
correct.
There's a big to-do about it.
Correct. And, you know, we're a year-round market, and so we also have an indoor market in the winter, and that obviously has always been a different location.
Right.
So now it's just every Saturday at the market, you know, at the farmer's market building.
So farmer's markets are being touted as basically one of the ways to address some of the many problems we have, namely genetically modified foods, unsustainable agricultural practices, and so on.
Absolutely.
How does that play out here in northern New Mexico?
Well, basically, the only way that small-scale farming is economically feasible is for the farmer to sell directly to the consumer at retail prices. So the vegetables and the food that you buy in the grocery store has had, you know, 2 or 3 middlemen between the farmer and the customer, and so the farmer then makes much less money. So obviously that's very important. But in northern New Mexico, there's a lot of development pressure up north. You know, there's very beautiful places on the rivers that, you know, would be great to be chopped up into, you know, 2-acre places with McMansions on them and whatnot, and having a viable farmer's market really helps preserve rural farmland here in northern New Mexico.
So a lot of people have been actually able to sustain their farms because of the Santa Fe farmer's market.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to be sort of honest about this. You know, the average farmer in the United States makes less than $10,000 a year from farming, and, you know, I'm sure our farmers, most of them make less than $25,000 a year from farming.
Most of them have either other income in their family or they also do other things?
Right. It's sort of a mixture. It's very interesting. There's many that are really trying to do it for a living. Of the farmers, I would say easily a third, you know, it's their primary thing. Then many of them are retired. Retired from the lab or retired from something else, and they've been trying to do it. And then others just, you know, the spouse.
We have a lot of farmers who are retired lab workers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So they know more than a little bit about fertilizer and...
Well, I mean, I actually jokingly said, you know, we have an application. I want to add that question, you know, do you currently or have you formerly worked at the lab? Because, you know, many of our, you know, the majority of our farmers are Santa Fe and Rio Riba County. And, you know, that's the biggest employer.
It's interesting because there are farmers and ranchers who are multi-generational going way
yes.
back, and there are those who have, like, gone from the cities and decided
yes.
that they want to go back to the land.
Yes.
Could you have a sense of what the breakdown is?
You know, I would say, you know, we're very unique here in northern New Mexico. Most of our farmers, I would say, you know, most meaning 55%, you know, just barely more than half are old Hispanic folks who are farming on the land that they've had for generations.
And are their children going into the business?
It doesn't look that way to me, but in some cases they are, but in some cases it's something that the children are going to do later, you know. But that, you know, about half I think are that case, and it's kind of in their blood and they just kind of have to do it. They've always done it. They love doing it. And then there's sort of another generation of folks, either younger or older, that just really want to live that lifestyle of, you know, working outside and living on the land and growing food.
They like read a lot of books and go on the internet and figure out things about growing cycles.
Yeah, and they learn from each other. You know, there's a very strong, like here, you know, we have interns. They have interns. The farmers have interns who then eventually go off and...
Is that a farmer's market program?
It's not really a farmer's market program, although informally we do try to connect interns with farmers.
We're talking to George Gundry of the Santa Fe Farmer's Market. The things that they are growing are things that grow in northern New Mexico, which is a pretty wide variety of,
right.
of items.
Correct. And, you know, everything from the traditional things, melons, chilies, beans, chicos, to, you know, baby bok choy and, you know, kinds of arugula that you've never seen. And it's really fingerling potatoes, shishito peppers are very hot. They're these little tiny peppers.
So we're getting into sort of the gourmet line of food
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that's really cool for me is it's the farmer's market, and it's truly a market where the farmers are all competing against each other. And, you know, often it's a friendly competition. Sometimes it's not so friendly. But they're trying to grow different things and have unique products. And you really get a diversity of food that you just can't get at the grocery store, even at Whole Foods or at the co-op.
That is very true. And also probably less packaging.
Virtually no packaging.
Well,
yes.
I've been trying to think about, knowing about the evils of plastic bags, how you're supposed to get things that are very small and numerous to your house without plastic bags.
Yeah. I mean, we go through a lot of plastic bags. In fact, we're working to provide the biodegradable plastic bags to
yes.
our farmers.
That's very excellent. Excellent work. So, another conversation about sustainable farming. Well, first of all, to what extent are the farmers in the farmers market doing either official or de facto organic farming?
Right. I would say the vast majority of the vegetable growers, if not all of them, are growing using organic methods. They are not certified organic. So if you're certified, there's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of bureaucracy. You also have to pay the New Mexico Organic Commodity Commission 1% of your gross to them. So many of our farmers are very committed to sustainable growing, but they don't feel a need to be certified because they know their customers and their customers know them. And if the customer has a question about how it's grown, of course, they can ask the farmer. They can come visit the farm in just about any case.
Do people do that? Do customers
absolutely.
Go up and make friends and visit
absolutely.
The farm?
Absolutely. And we have an organized event, which is the last Sunday of August, which is the farm tour, where several of the farms have open houses. And last year, I would say we easily had 1,000 people participate in that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, another part of it is sustainable water use in a period of not only desert landscape and probably increasing drought, but especially drought exacerbated by climate change. The farmers, the way they are farming, water conservationary methods that they're using? Are they using drip irrigation?
Right. You know, it's really all over the map, and I think it's... certainly, like, if you look at vegetables, drip irrigation is most commonly used, and it's not necessarily for, you know, saving water for conservation. It's just the most efficient way to put the water where you want it. It also discourages weeds, you know.
Right.
The other way to do it, the traditional way, is flood irrigation. We've basically got an open ditch, and the water floods, and it's much harder to direct it. You use a lot more water.
Right.
But, of course, there's lots of research now showing that the acequia system, where we have these acequias coming off the rivers, really preserves a lot of water by kind of spreading it out and putting it into the ground so that it actually that water appears downstream.
How functional is the acequia system in northern New Mexico compared to other kinds of irrigation?
What do you mean by functional?
I mean, are the people using it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's every farmer that we have just about is taking their water off an acequia.
And is that the majority of the water that they use for their farming?
Absolutely.
Very interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. We're in the desert. You do need a lot of water, and the water comes from rivers. So, you know, our farmers are all just about on rivers. And it comes out of an acequia. And, of course, you know, the acequia system is written into the New Mexico Constitution. And, you know, it's a part of our government. It's a part of our law.
Now, speaking of part of our government and part of our law, are there, or in your view, should there be incentives so that farmers can stay on the land and continue farming?
Absolutely.
Or there should be?
There definitely should be. And there are some pretty good ones. New Mexico has a very good... agricultural easement program, where basically you can be paid by the state. It's a tax credit for creating an easement, which basically is a legal document that doesn't allow your land to be developed and has to remain in agriculture in perpetuity.
And do a lot of people use that?
Well, it's kind of new. I know for sure of one farmer that has done it, and actually what happened is he doesn't own the land he works, but the owner has done that. But it's actually it's sort of becoming more important now because the biggest challenge for farmers, if I have to say there's one big challenge, is the price of the land here in northern New Mexico.
Right.
So if, you know, and it's crazy. Like in Velarde and stuff, you know, it's anywhere from like, you know, $50,000 to $90,000 an acre.
An acre.
For
oh
irrigated
my goodness.
Land. So, so if you can, you know, have a big chunk of that taken off by getting an easement,
then it's not worth so much because you can't develop it, and therefore it becomes affordable for farming.
Exactly. Well, that's the theory. I don't know if it really becomes that affordable, but it obviously becomes less expensive.
So let's go back to the building. This is in the rail yard, and I think it's a building that meets all sorts of criteria for energy conservation.
Correct. It's what they call LEED, L-E-E-D, Leadership in Energy Efficient Design. It's silver certification, and it's a very green building.
Is it colored green?
It's actually not. I think it is. Yeah, it's colored green on the outside, yes. And it's, you know, the it's got solar water, which is hooked into the heating system. It's got, you know, natural light throughout. 50% of the building materials came from a 500-mile radius of Santa Fe or less. A certain percentage, I think it's 75% of the waste materials from the construction was reused or recycled. Non-toxic, you know, paints and all that kind of stuff. So it's a green building. It's the second LEED certified building in Santa Fe, and it's only, I think there's only 5 LEED certified buildings in New Mexico.
One of the conversations that I've been having off the air with people is about whether it actually costs more to build a building using energy conservation or not.
Based on the $5 million price tag of our building, absolutely it costs more. But if you look at the total cost of ownership,
Over a period of years.
A period of 10 years, 20 years, it saves a lot of money.
Because, I mean, things like orienting the windows and making them the right size and having the proper overhangs don't cost you a penny.
That's true. That's true. If you're doing new construction, it's kind of like, you know, solar power generally, like solar electric. It almost makes no sense if you're building a new home not to put solar into it. If you have an existing home, then it's, you know, it's expensive. But, you know, depending on how you look at it, I think there is a, you know, you can build a building a lot cheaper if you disregard, you know, energy efficiency and all those kind of things. And that's kind of the problem with the whole system is there's not a motivation for a builder to, you know, the motivation for the builder is to build the house as cheaply as possible. And the cost of ownership later is not really his or her problem.
Not to mention, but then there's, you know, the cost of ownership, but then there's the cost to society.
That too.
Of having, you know, of having climate change.
Sure. And toxicity.
And toxicity. Yeah. We're talking to George Gundry, Executive Director of the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Is there anything else that you want to let people know about before we go?
Well, I just want to remind folks that the market is in full swing right now. We actually have 3 markets a week. Saturdays at the PERA building, 7 a.m. to noon. Tuesdays behind the Santa Fe Children's Museum at 1050 Old Pecos Trail, and Thursday afternoons on the south side in the parking lot of Santa Fe Place.
So what fruits are already out?
Well, the cherries have come and gone.
The cherries have indeed come and gone.
Yes.
On my one cherry tree, the birds ate every single cherry. I did not get one.
You know, that's how I learned recently, that's how you can tell that the cherries are ripe. The birds will not eat them until the cherries are just perfect.
I do know
so
that.
So as soon as you see the birds out there, get out there. But, and now we've got plums and peaches, and there's a few what they call summer apples. And, you know, more and more apples will be coming in.
George Gundry, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Lehi Shepherd. She is an organic gardener and community activist, and she's here to talk about community gardens and all sorts of good things. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So Tessa Horan is a young woman who died tragically a couple of years ago the victim of a shark attack.
Right.
And you are starting a Tessa Horan community garden, or have already done so.
Yes, we've already started that. It's in full bloom and looks beautiful. Tessa was a young girl that grew up here in Santa Fe and joined the Peace Corps. And then she had worked with me doing organic gardening while she lived here. She worked on the ski patrol with us and was a really close friend and great part of the community. And we thought through her death, we realized that we should maybe focus on some positive things in our community that in her memory. And so one of the first things we've done here is the community garden.
And so where is this garden?
It's 1205 Don Gaspar.
And what do you grow there?
We grow all kinds of food, everything edible. And we have a children's play garden with teepees and runner beans on the teepees and things for them to do, big dirt pile to dig in. And the idea being that moms can come, bring their kids can play, they can work in the garden, interact with other mothers, and everybody has a great time, brings home some good food and learns about gardening and taking care of the earth and reconnecting with the earth.
So the people who participate in the garden, they can show up, garden, take home their food to eat.
Right.
But you also feed others who need to eat, who haven't been growing this food.
Right. The idea with this garden was to try to focus on people who might not have a whole lot of knowledge about growing their own food and also may not have enough money or funds set up to purchase food like that from the organic food stores and stuff in town.
And the farmer's market, which we were just talking about.
Exactly. And so it's a way to educate people. A lot of people that I've talked to said, I don't know how to garden. And the idea is that this is sort of a teaching module. We'd like people to come and learn how to garden. And we've set up a water catchment system. We use drip irrigation. We've used mulch to keep the beds really moist and so we can use as little water as possible to grow this food. We have a really beautiful composting area, if you think compost is beautiful, I do. But we use everything. All the materials in the garden have been our recycled materials and donated from people in the community. So it's really kind of a neat community thing.
And you also donate to the Food Depot and Kitchen Angels.
Right. We've been picking food for the Kitchen Angels. And this week I took 27 pounds of food over there, kale and all kinds of zucchinis and lettuces and different sorts of food for them. And we'll plan on doing that about once a week now.
As more food comes up.
As more comes in. We have a group of women that are through the Sojourners Cafe, which is sort of a halfway house from Esperanza, the women's shelter, that have been working with us. I talked to the kids at the Santa Fe High School. There's 40 kids there with babies, and so I went to the Parent Teen Center
really?
And said, we'd love to have you guys come work in our garden, learn about gardening, bring your kids. And now we're doing some fundraisers so that we can actually pay some of these women to be able to learn how to garden, work in our garden, take food home, and not have to find daycare. It seems like a pretty good setup.
We're talking to Lehigh Shepherd. Now, there's also a garden-to-table dinner, and the next one is on Sunday, August 10th. That's coming up fairly soon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's going to be one of our fundraising dinners. We did one last month that was just a great success. It was so fun and so beautiful, and the food was amazing. Abby Souza from Contoured Cooking is the chef. And we use most of the food out of the garden. Everything in the dinner is locally procured. So if we don't grow it, we get it from the farmer's market or somewhere here in Santa Fe. And it's just going to be a really fun time. It'll be 6:30 on Sunday the 10th, 1205 Don Gaspar.
And if people want to sort of sign up to come, do you have to do that?
Yeah. They need to call. And they can call me at 660-2736. And we're asking for a $50 donation for the dinner.
And we'll give that number again at the end of the program. Now, you're also doing something else, which is a proposed state penitentiary gardening project.
That's right. That's an exciting project. I'm really hoping that we get to do that project. I've written up a proposal and sent it to the Secretary of Corrections and a few other people, and I haven't heard back as of now, but I'm hoping that they will figure out some way to get those guys growing their food and, just for to reintegrate into society and have something hopeful to look forward to and something positive to do while they're there, not to mention the benefits of good nutrition.
Not to mention the benefits of good nutrition,
yeah.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. Somebody was, we were talking about a program in California where somebody figured out that the students in the schools were eating just really unnutritious food, and meanwhile the organic farmers didn't have enough of a market. So they put them together, and the schools bought the food from the organic markets, farmers fed it to their children, mm-hmm. in the schools, and everybody was happy.
It's a great thing.
It's kind of a no-brainer, but somebody has to organize it.
Well, and we have a little bit of a different setup here because the schools are usually out during our growing season. You know, there's a lot longer growing season in California, so I think they're a little easier to access them. But most of the kids aren't in school in the summer, and that's when we have most of the food. So
right.
It's a little bit tough. But we've had some homeschool groups come by our garden and learn about growing food. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be that you have a big piece of land. People think, oh, I need all this space to grow a garden. Well, we're doing container gardening and teaching people about, you know, you can grow all kinds of stuff in a pot right there on your patio. And you're using the water anyhow. So edible landscaping to me has become a really big thing. I'm thinking, why not have it be something you can eat instead of just, and it looks beautiful too. So.
And so when you grow, for example, when I grow container herbs, mm-hmm. they get eaten instantaneously by the grasshoppers.
Do you live outside of town?
No.
They must just like your stuff, huh? Well, there's different things that you can do to keep the grasshoppers at bay. You can use garlic and grind up grasshoppers and spray it around, and they seem to stay away. But you do have to kind of be on top of it. Other thing is covers.
You grind up grasshoppers?
Well, blended grasshoppers, yes, that's one
they
thing.
They don't like, because, oh.
I know. Isn't that horrible?
Ladies and gentlemen, yes.
Tips.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose that's what you learn if you're doing a community garden. If you start participating
right.
in this, everybody's giving their little tips about non-toxic.
They start sharing their ideas or things they've heard from their grandparents or, you know, that sort of thing. And you learn all kinds of different things.
Any other community gardens planned?
Oh, yeah. Well, I met with Brian Dreipulcher from the Trust for Public Land, and they're doing the Rail Yard Center down there. And they have a piece of property that's set aside for a community garden. And it will be irrigated off the acequia in the old Spanish tradition. I've been a farmer here in northern New Mexico for 30 years and lived up near Peñasco and farmed that way. And so I'm really looking forward to figuring out how to make that a community space and actually irrigate off the Acequia Madre here. That'd be really neat.
Amazing. This mm-hmm. is actually happening in the city of Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Makes one feel almost hopeful for 40 seconds here and there.
Isn't it great? I think if everybody pulls together, we can all figure something out that'll work, you know, take care of each other.
Lehi Shepherd is an organic gardener and community activist. If you're interested in the Garden to Table fundraising dinner on Sunday, August 10th, you can give a call to 660-2736. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. And, you know, one other thing I'd like to say, if you're interested in volunteering or learning about gardening, please call. We'd love to have more help.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some good food. What are your favorite foods that your community garden is growing?
We have these beautiful eggplants right now. We have three different types. We have the Japanese long, skinny ones, and we have some of the blush that are white with the beautiful pale purple on them. They're gorgeous. And lots of kale, lots of carrots, turnips, beets, all kinds of stuff like that. So everything in there is really good.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Bye. Thank you.